Hello, welcome to the Citywire Funds Fanatic podcast. This is the second in the series. I'm Gavin Lumsden, editor of Investment Trust Insider at Citywire. With me is Daniel Grote, editor of Citywire Funds Insider website. Hi, Dan, how are you doing?
Hi, Gavin.
Last time we talked about the stock market crash and the dividend crisis, the huge cuts in payouts that are hitting investment funds and investment trusts. But this time we're going to talk about the other big story this year, Mark Barnett, fund manager Invesco, who was sacked by the Perpetual Income and Growth Investment Trust. That's the last investment trust he was running. He'd run it for 20 years.
I mean, actually, to be fair, I hadn't appreciated that until, until his position really kind of came under pressure, that he'd been in charge of that trust for that long. I guess I'd conflated it with Edinburgh, where he replaced Woodford, but
you can date his underperformance, his problems date from Neil Woodford, his former boss and his mentor, upping sticks to go off and form his own fund. And we know what happened to Neil Woodford and Woodford Investment Management last year. But the legacy that left Mark Barnett, in retrospect, was a bad one. It gave him a big job, head of UK equities at Invesco, which Woodford had filled, and it gave him Woodford's big income funds, the open-ended funds, income and high income, Invesco, as well as the Edinburgh Trust. And suddenly his workload just increased massively, and roughly since then the performance, his style was out of fashion, his stock picks were going wrong, some of them. It's complicated because obviously there's a whole Brexit uncertainty clouding prospects for UK stock markets, and he was piling more and more into undervalued domestic stocks, and they just weren't getting re-rated. So that's, it's hard to, there's not just one, there never is just one thing leading to, performance going badly off the boil. But, with Perpetual Income, it's worth pointing out, 20-year track record. And for the first 16 years, before he took on lots of other duties after Woodford left, a fantastic record. I mean, I think it was 14 out of those 16 calendar years he beat the All Share.
But I guess his sacking is not a surprise. Maybe the timing of it is, in the sense that it's come quite late. It's come after Edinburgh, the larger trust sort of.
Well, Edinburgh surprised everyone because there was no announcement from Edinburgh that they were reviewing the situation. They just came out with saying, we've been concerned for some time and we're picking Majedy. And that was a double surprise because Majedy Asset Management, a good outfit, good boutique, sprung out of Mercury Asset Management a long time ago. So they've still got the same initials, MAM, MAM. But, recently their overall performance hasn't been that brilliant. But it was a surprise. It was a surprise, there was no announcement that they were doing a review, and then they just picked, a kind of somebody from left field, it would appear. At that point, Perpetual Income, I mean, this was, I think, 2 days before the general election. So Perpetual Income quite sensibly said, not having made the decision, and they were being accused of bottling it and everything. But they had been making, more and more sterner noises in their statements at results time. So, we kind of knew something was up. But they said that they weren't going to do anything 2 days before an election because that election result could change everything. And it nearly did, didn't it? Because Perpetual Income, just before the election, when it looked like the Conservatives were going to get in, and then obviously afterwards, all these UK domestic type funds were doing really well. Perpetual Income was up 5% in December. Alone.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at it now and it seems like a fillip, doesn't it? Whereas at the time, and certainly, the noises that kind of value-focused UK managers were making was that, this is the turning point. We've had these sort of horrendous 2 to 3 years when, this part of the market has been massively underrated because of the Brexit vote and because of the outlook for the UK economy, and the election just seemed to kind of crystallise this,
All sorts of funds and trusts that do really badly were suddenly doing really well. UK mid-cap particularly was just flying. Temple Bar, which is interesting from a sort of the dividend pressure we're talking about. That Temple Bar, run by Alistair Mundy at Investec, you know, he has been struggling for years as well. But second half of last year, because of this kind of Brexit uncertainty, seemed to be lifting. It was flying away. And then you just thought the election result was going to could be the start of a whole new better streak for it. And then what do we get? We get pandemic.
And you look at what's happened in terms of the stock market reaction to the pandemic, and it's the UK has been one of the hardest hit stock markets, and the FTSE 250, which features a lot of those sort of domestic focused companies that derive most of the revenue from the UK economy, they've been hit even harder than the blue chips in the FTSE 100, and so kind of bringing the conversation about Barnett onto the open-ended funds now are his sort of main focus. He's had another terrible run of performance. He's towards the bottom of his sector since the turn of the year. The funds have lost around sort of 37% over that period, and that's just widened this sort of huge gap that's emerging between him and the sort of trading pack in the sector and everyone else. He was to some extent being protected by his old mentor Neil Woodford when his fund was still around, because that was right at the bottom, but that's been taken out of the equation now, and so it just piles more pressure onto
him. It was incredible, wasn't it, the end of last year, how quickly Barnett became the focus of media and all investors' attention. Woodford exploded. It was just like the you were all over that story. Woodford's demise was just the biggest story we've ever handled, and yet it happens. Quite a long drawn out saga. It dominates last year, but then it happens, and then immediately, the following week, everyone's talking about Barnett.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are striking sort of similarities between the two that stretch beyond just the fact that they worked for the same company and were colleagues. Barnett's running Woodford's old funds, so even 5 to 6 years down the line, there are still sort of aspects of those funds that have largely been inherited from Woodford. So you've got this sort of tail of unquoted companies, and obviously unquoted companies.
Isn't that quite a small position in private equity, and aren't they getting rid of it?
And so it's nothing like of the scale that Woodford ended up kind of running in his funds, and that kind of proved to be part of his undoing. But they have been growing.
More important, isn't it, Dan? Because he's facing these, he's got these massive performance questions about his performance. But in terms of structural viability, they're not in the situation that Woodford Equity Income was last year, when Woodford just couldn't sell the private equity, the unquoted, quick enough. The value of the public equities kept on falling, and the proportion of the unquoted was always threatening to go above the maximum allowed, and it destabilised the fund, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there are sort of the same sort of forces at play, but on a smaller scale. So with Woodford's fund, at the end of that fund's lifetime, he was essentially holding twice the amount that you're normally allowed to hold in unquoted companies, and he did that by listing them on Guernsey Stock Exchange to sort of get around the rules. With Barnett's funds, he hasn't had to resort to that kind of chicanery, but it is worth pointing out that last week, the value of his unquoted companies was slashed by around 16% as part of his plan to sell them off. The valuers just took the view that, if you've moved from becoming a holder of these companies to a seller, and you're trying to sell them into this marketplace right now, you're not going to fetch what we've been valuing them at. Before he'd done that, before those values had been cut, the percentage of his fund in unquoted companies was creeping up towards that 10% limit, which is, the limit that the city regulator polices. you know, the reason it was creeping up wasn't because he was buying more unquoted companies. It was because the value of his, the rest of his funds was declining at a sort of fairly precipitous rate. Yeah, to some extent, that was down to people pulling money from his funds, but to a large extent, it was just down to the fall in the value of his funds as stock markets have plunged.
Has Invesco nipped that problem in the bud before it, you know, before it threatened to become out of hand, like it did with Woodford? You know, they've slashed the valuation, and they're going to sell them.
Yeah, I mean, purely in a mathematical sense, they have, because, you know, they've gone from the, you know, the those positions, you know, being around sort of 9% of the fund to, you know, being around a third of that figure. You would think they would have difficulty selling them, because you know, it's not a market for buyers really at the moment, certainly not of you know, illiquid unquoted companies. But I guess the in terms of, you know, you mentioned the sort of structural viability of the funds. I think it's not just about unquoted companies. You know, in Woodford's case, it wasn't just about unquoted companies. It was about, you know, a lot of the stuff that is listed on the stock market, but it's really small and it's really hard to trade. So if you've got lots of people pulling money out of your fund, it's really hard to sell those companies to then fund the redemptions from investors. You know, and on that front,
is exposure to illiquid stocks in general.
Yeah. You know, they're listed, but it's still hard to trade them. And on that front, you know, Invesco, really since Woodford imploded and since the fund was suspended, they've been at pains to, you know, articulate how they are trying to improve the liquidity of the funds. You know, and so Barnett's saying that, you know, that's improving sort of on a weekly and a daily basis. So just because they sold the unquoted companies, that doesn't mean, you know, liquidity doesn't become an issue anymore. And, you know, they're saying that the liquidity of the funds, you know, in terms of all the rest of the stuff that they hold is improving. So, you know, we just have to see.
We will. So do you think he's, how long will investors give him, do you think? I mean, investors have been pulling money out of those funds at a rate of knots.
Well, it's really hard to see sort of, you know, what does success look like from this point? Because, you know, the funds have been underperforming, for so long. And that sort of accelerated really into the sell-off. So the one consolation that you would have had maybe a year ago holding that sort of fund was that, you know, I've done badly, but my manager keeps telling me that, you know, these undervalued cheap companies, you know, are disproportionately so, you know, they're too cheap and they're going to rebound. And I guess you had that kind of cruel taste of the tentative signs of the success of that approach after the election. And then you just had, you know, and it's not just a Mark Barnett, an Invesco kind of phenomenon. The kind of value approach that he has adopted, that's been punished, you know, those funds have been punished harder than others in this sell-off.
Absolutely. And so, no, well, if I just bring in an example from the trust world, yeah, it's not just Mark Barnett who's suffering, it's value managers per se. So Temple Bar, you know, well-known, popular UK equity income trust, you know, with a really deep value style, which has, you know, not performed well under Alistair Mundy, the fund manager. But as I said earlier, started rallying second half of last year. But then the coronavirus fears hit us and that gets completely snuffed out. The shares halved in the first quarter. And now it turns out analysts are scouring all these trusts in light of their exposure to dividend cuts. And they've got the biggest exposure to the sectors where dividends cuts are most, you know, most prevalent, financials and possibly oils and that sort of thing. So it's pretty cruel.
Well, these value managers
in that trust.
Yeah, and
but on the other hand, who's it benefiting? Well, you know, who's the best known investment trust in that sector? It's Finsbury Growth and Income, run by Nick Train. You know, great track record, leading the sector over most time periods, certainly over 10 years, and you know, it's got the least exposure to dividend cuts. So suddenly everything's conspiring to make its, you know, Train's focus on quality growth stocks, which aren't exposed to, you know, the economic cycles as much as others. Everything's conspiring to make, you know, it look really, really good.
Well, and its position. And we've got the same thing with open-ended funds. It's, you know, it's the funds that did well before this that have done well after it. So, you know, Fundsmith and Lindsay Train, both their UK and their global funds, because, you know, those funds have got investments in, you know, there's a lot of technology sort of focused companies in there. So the kinds of companies that, you know, they're well suited or they're better suited than others to, you know, a world in which vast portions of the global population is sat at home because they're not allowed out. And then, then they hold, you know, consumer staples companies, you know, producing soap and toothpaste and, you know, hand sanitizer, you know, just the sorts of things where sales are going to hold up in the kind of crisis that we find ourselves in at the moment. And the flip side of that, like you were saying, is, you know, that it's those investors who've been sat in the funds that have performed poorly running up to this that have a value approach and, you know, invested in the more kind of cyclical areas of the economy, the cyclical kind of companies that are more exposed to the fluctuations of the UK and kind of global economies. They're the ones that have been really punished in this stock market sell-off. So that kind of gap between quality growth and value is just widening to really pretty exceptional levels.
So where does that leave us? Is there any point in having a value fund, do you think, for kind of diversification purposes? It feels, you know, your own sort of savings, or if you give an individual putting together a few funds and trusts in a SIP or an ISA, you know, it's dangerous to put all your eggs in one basket. Is it dangerous to have just growth funds, even though growth funds and trusts seem to be the ones doing really well at the moment?
It's hard to say, isn't it? Because, you know, on the one hand, you would think that, you know, how many times can a value manager go out to their investors and say, you know, we've had a bad year, but things will change. You know, they always do. And, you know, the mean will revert and, you know, the sorts of phrases that you hear from them.
It does get a bit tedious, doesn't it? But you know what? But there is value in value. I mean, I just think when you're saying that, you know, somebody like Alex Wright of Fidelity, you know, runs trusts and funds. You know, he always describes himself as a contrarian value investor, picking out of favour stocks and looking for things where there's a catalyst. So he reckons there's something's going to happen to, you know, make the company do well or for people to look at it in a better light. You know, actually, the past year and a half has been maybe a bit tricky. But actually, his record as a value fund manager is all right, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, he maybe hasn't been drawn to the real sort of extremes in terms of, you know, really kind of bombed out companies. And I think, you know, there are times where he's been drawn to kind of more sort of defensive sectors that might be a little bit more expensive than the kind of pure cyclical.
Yeah, he's a bit pragmatic, isn't he? A bit more flexible than some of the other real deep value merchants. Could be a reference to merchant investment trust. I don't know. They're not that deep value, but they're definitely value. So what's the conclusion of all this then?
It's those that have done badly are doing worse. Those that have done well are doing better. So is that going to change?
But what's that phrase around where people give up? That's the moment to, you know, when there's blood on the streets. And talking about stock markets here, when markets are really battered and have fallen and everyone's capitulating, then that's the moment.
Capitulation's the word, isn't it?
It's a good word, isn't it? What does it, you know, just does it apply to a style as well? You know, when people are totally giving up on value funds, is that the time to? You know, that's what I was asking. Is like maybe you do keep you know, one or two value funds or trusts in your portfolio if you've got, you know, if you've got a collection of them, just because you never know, it might bounce back. I mean, and hopefully, you know, this pandemic, you know, this crisis is not going to go on forever. We can't see the end of the tunnel, which is at the moment, we can't see light at the end of the tunnel, rather. So that's what's so damaging confidence and economic and stock market prospects. But, you know, we will get through it, won't we? So you just got to hope that some of these companies, that these companies that the funds are investing in will survive. But then that goes back to your point about it's the quality growth ones. They're the ones investing in companies that are strong, with strong balance sheets and who can weather storms.
Well, and I guess if you're looking for sort of light at the end of the tunnel for value strategies and for value funds, I mean, you only really have to look at the way stock markets have been behaving over the last few weeks, where, you know, as soon as there's any sort of tentative sign that the outlook might not be quite as bad as investors have thought, you know, it's all the companies that have been hit the hardest in this sell-off that were rising the most. If there's any sort of recovery, you know, those kind of value focused managers, you know, that will be their time to shine. And if they don't do it, then when's it going to happen?
So we're going to give them, they're going to get one more chance. Well, if you're still in some of these funds and these shares, you know, you've taken a lot of pain, so maybe you should hang on in there. But I think what you're saying is that they've got one more chance to get it right. When we do pull through this, then they've got to really motor.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that will give us something to look out for.